Hello listeners and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle and we'll be reviewing all of the European top five leagues this week as all of the titles have been retained. We've also got a bit on the FA Cup, but before we get into all of it, let me introduce the people that will be telling you about those boring, boring leagues. First up is chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Hello, Mo.
I'm great. It's just farmers everywhere, mate.
I know. All of the leagues, how boring. All being ruined. And also joining me is today's Serie A expert, Will Hall. How are you, Will?
That's a lot of pressure.
I know.
I feel overwhelmed.
Overwhelmed.
Proud to have been referred to as a Serie A
yes,
expert, though.
Exactly. I want to hype you up so that people are ready to listen to the stories of the seasons. And the Bundesliga correspondent, chief expert extraordinaire, is Mr. Sam Long. Are you right, Sam?
Very well, thank you.
A departure from your League One
expertise.
Yeah. I'm picking up the German league this week.
Man of many talents.
Exactly. And that is one we do know. A team of many talents, if you will, to start off, is obviously Man City, the first men's side to win a domestic treble and also winning the Community Shield as well, if you would like to include that one. But if you do include that, that means that Jose Mourinho is not the only manager to beat him in a final, because Dortmund and Dieter Hecking before had done it in the DFL Super Cup. But moving on from that, obviously, Man City 6-0, the joint biggest win in an FA Cup final. It seems so long ago now that they did actually win, Sam. But it was almost what happened afterwards that was the more important. Vincent Kompany lifted his final title as a Manchester City player, his 10th in his time at the club. And since his first season, that is more than any other English team. So a clear era of dominance for Vincent Kompany and that Manchester City team, crowned by this another historic season under Pep Guardiola. So rather than talk about the game, the 6-0 and the disappointment of brilliant for Watford to get there and perhaps a harsh result, let's dive into the after effects of it all. And Vincent Kompany and himself, now player manager of Anderlecht, his boyhood club. Where is he going to be ranked now in terms of all-time Premier League greats? Because I think it's already objectively clear he's a Man City legend.
Mm. First of all, I think the time is right for him to go, and he really has nailed it, because it's quite often that we see players sort of hang around for a bit too long, their bodies start to let them down, reduce playing time. If you look at John Terry when he left Chelsea, I think he announced his exit in the tunnel at Milton Keynes. So that sort of shows you how it can be unglamorous if you get it wrong.
But then he was substituted in the 26th minute.
God, that was terrible.
Of course, yeah. So he got his sent off at the end. He got his sent off at the end. But my point is that if you stick around, then your legacy becomes a bit tarnished. Kompany's obviously signed off in style. So 10 titles, like you said. He's been in the PFA Team of the Year on three occasions. He definitely had a spell where he was probably the best centre-back in the league.
Yeah.
But I probably wouldn't put him in the top bracket of Premier League centre-backs with Terry, Rio, Tony Adams, but I'd probably say he is at the very top of the next bracket, if that makes sense.
Best of the rest.
Best of the rest. Because I think injuries definitely took their toll with him. He lost a bit of pace. He only made 30-plus Premier League appearances in three seasons and definitely started to creak as he got older. But I think what sets him apart is what he's done off the pitch. He's become almost like a statesman-like figure in the last couple of seasons. Not scared to speak out on issues outside of football, which is pretty rare at the top level. Man City are going to have a difficult time replacing him.
And that's the thing, though, as well. In terms of Vincent Kompany, the player, you mentioned there that he's not been playing too often. Turning up for those big moments, obviously, that goal against Leicester was a fairy tale written, his first ever goal from outside the box for the club, and probably was the reason they won the title in the end. But if you're going to say, as a player, maybe these last few years haven't been his most dominant periods, because he struggled as well. I think there was quite a sort of similar story running that he kept making those really lunging fouls and being caught out a bit, which was a sign of his sort of dwindling physicality. Mm. However, as you said there, as a captain, it almost becomes a different conversation in terms of ranking him as a captain, because he's taken a team that obviously he arrived before all the money was poured into it as well.
It's a different test of your leadership, isn't it? If you're not on the pitch, but you're still leading within the dressing room, that's arguably more difficult to influence the dressing room.
Exactly, and you look at all of the outpouring of people like Phil Foden and even Zinchenko, but then also David Silva and stuff as well, saying that he's been there for all of them that whole time. So he's going to be a massive presence missed off the pitch, as if not on it, in the sense that they've had Laporte, Otamendi, Stones, those three rotating and being good enough. Laporte especially is sort of maybe taking his role as the leader on the pitch in terms of always playing the ball, and being the sort of proponent of Pep Guardiola's football from centre-back. But the time comes where you think, despite John Stones' obvious potential and Pep Guardiola being a fan of John Stones, there's obviously that famous interview where he said he had more balls than any journalist in the room at the time. And I'm a big fan of John Stones myself, and I thought he was brilliant at the World Cup. It looks like they're going to make a big leap again to try and bring in a centre-back to replace Kompany, and if not improve upon him. It seems to me it should be as a partner to Laporte. And obviously we know they're going to have whatever money they wish to find a target. They've shown that they're not willing to spend beyond. They have the money to spend, but with Virgil van Dijk and the likes of Fred and Jorginho, they've sort of pulled back if they ever thought it was too much. But if they identify a target and they meet the price, they can get whoever. So my question is to you, Mo, is there anyone that you think they should be putting a priority on, and who do you think they might have already looked at?
One name, three words, Matthijs de Ligt. There's only, if you're replacing Vinny Kompany, there's only one. Like you said, the man's captain, leader, legend, massive influence. You know, he's on City's Mount Rushmore with Yaya Touré, David Silva and Sergio Aguero, right? The all-time greatest City players, right? He's phenomenal, and on the pitch you can replace him pretty easily. John Stones, you could promote Eric Garcia from the youth team. I don't think there'd be too much work. I mean, John Stones is better than Kompany on the field when he's fit, but it's that, like Sam said, it's that presence, that leadership he has. That's so hard to get. You need to find someone who has that, or at least an approximation of that. And then you look at, and just this weekend, Matthijs de Ligt's speech to the Ajax fans, you know, where he's 19 years old and he's talking like he's 29, and he's just like an absolute undisputed. No one standing behind him doubted him. No one was like thinking, who is this kid? Everyone bought into everything he was saying about Ajax, about the club. And the stuff he was saying is stuff that was obviously based on the philosophies of Cruyff, which is what Guardiola buys into as well. It's a match made in absolute, it's heaven. It's perfect. He plays right centre back, comes in again next to Laporte. Stones can play. I'm sure Stones will get more games next season as well. But there's always that thing with Stones is, is there an injury coming? Is there a mistake coming? There seems to be a confidence issue with him. I don't know what it is. But look, Ligt has no confidence issues.
No. You know? But is prone to mistakes. And,
yeah.
But at 19,
he's
clear.
He's 19, yeah. I mean, Kompany's prone to mistakes. Exactly. That was the thing. So it's not like they'd be... And, you know, all of their centre-backs are kind of have a rick in them, which is probably what undoes them in the Champions League all the time.
And even though that when you've got 75% of the ball probably on average, that you're exposed to a... Well, you're not in a defensive
line.
Yeah,
when you play
halfway
up the pitch, there's so much more margin for error. Like, you can make a mistake without actually having to make a mistake. Like, that's the one thing with Barcelona's defenders, like, and in Bayern's when they were there, and now City's defenders, is they can be just standing in the wrong position, five yards in the wrong position, and you've made a mistake, and someone can score a goal. And it's not because you've flubbed on the ball. Like, it's just because you've been stood in the wrong place. So that's the margin of error you play with under Pep Guardiola. So you've mentioned
De Ligt there as sort of the target that you think should happen. And the name that's been sort of bandied about the most in press and reports recently is Leicester's Harry Maguire. Obviously, alongside John Stones at the World Cup.
Yeah.
However, my personal thought on that is I'm a massive fan of Harry Maguire and his massive head. So there's no doubt
swapping that, one big head for another. Though.
Exactly, yeah. But if you're looking to replace Kompany in every way possible, Harry Maguire is perhaps the man to do it.
Physically, yes.
But the thing with Harry Maguire that makes him such a unique centre-back, and why he obviously has the talent to play for Man City, in my opinion. But if you ever watch him play, and you watch him play in that back three at the World Cup, he played as the left-sided centre-back because he dribbles out with the ball on the outside of his right foot, and all of his body movements and the way he positions himself on the pitch, especially on the ball, is as if he were an inverted winger. Yeah. And it's so odd to see someone of such a colossal size address themselves on the ball as if they were this fleet-footed winger. But if you don't play him on the left side of your centre-back partnership, when obviously you would play Laporte as a left footer, look at the passes he's been playing, you remove what makes Harry Maguire so unique and so good, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say exactly that when you brought Maguire up. That's the one thing is you wonder, like, could he translate those skills to the right side of defence? Mm. You're never so sure. Like, I mean, Pep had he's had this issue before with Chiginski when he brought him to Barcelona. Chiginski played left centre-back for Shakhtar and then came to Barcelona and was playing on the right, and it just didn't look...
Doesn't look the same.
Yeah, and so, I mean, look, Maguire could adapt. There's no doubt. I mean, Sterling adapted to playing actual right wing, you know, when he's used to opening his body up playing on the left. So it's entirely possible, but I would agree with you. His best weapon is something, well, not his best weapon, but like this key element of him, which makes him so suited to your team. Do you necessarily want to curb that and move him on the right?
And obviously you can sort of adjust yourself to do that on the right-hand side, but then you start messing your body up and intertwining
it's a whole different thing.
Showing your different self into angles. And as we said before about the Virgil van Dijk thing, like the story of him being a right-back when he was younger and being short and not very good, now is a left-sided centre-back and has looked more uncomfortable on that right-hand side. So side can make a massive difference for centre-backs, and you want that perfect pairing. So Maguire, for the prices that are being bandied about, I would say that it would be more of a risk. However, there probably aren't many other centre-backs about that. He ticks the homegrown box as well, which is obviously going to become more of an...
I think Zuma could be an outside shout. I don't think Chelsea seem overly keen on him. And I mean, he's not necessarily as good with the ball as you'd like, but you can coach that.
But that's why Sarri loaned him out, I think. Because if Sarri wants his centre-backs to play football and he got loaned out, then I don't think Pep Guardiola was going to identify a similar player.
No, I know. I think the technical and the defensive strength is enormous off the charts for Zuma. So it's just a matter of like... You can coach him to play with the ball. You give him a bit more confidence, a bit more trust, and he could learn. I mean, you never know. But I think in terms of budget options, he could be quite good. Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't.
They don't need a budget option though. They can choose whoever they want.
That's true.
Would you be advocating a move for Yerry Mina as well, Mo?
Yerry Mina is the greatest defender in the world, so obviously yes. But no,
they need someone to head it.
Yes, 100%.
Right. Man City company replacements sorted. Maguire versus De Ligt seems to be the major shouts there. In terms of Man City as a team, though, 100 points last season, 98 this season with a domestic treble. History being made now sort of on a regular basis by this Pep Guardiola team. He's obviously been linked to Juventus' job and said, I don't know why you keep linking me there. I'm not going it. So he's going to be at Man City next season, pretty sure, almost 100% sure. How does... he now outdo this season, which, as we said, is the first time it's been done in the men's game by a team.
The how is quite plain, I think, personally. The company is the tip of the iceberg in terms of replacing company. I think he's also got to replace... I think this is the summer in which he's also got to replace the other remnants of that 2013-14 Premier League winning side. Sergio Aguero's kind of tried to replace already. You'll probably get a couple more seasons out of him. But the sort of replacement they have waiting for him in the wings, one of the best young, most exciting young strikers in world football, you would say, Gabriel Jesus, has kind of not enjoyed perhaps the smooth progression of development we might have expected under a coach like Pep Guardiola. Obviously, Aguero has been a reason for that, but you're seeing like links away, and although they're not ironclad links away, they're not a great sign. David Silva is another one. He's 33 now. His influence clearly waned this season, although he remains a great player. But a smart club is looking to replace players like that like one or two seasons before they absolutely have to. You could say with David Silva, though, of course, that Bernardo Silva represents a ready-made replacement for him, and the way they could rejig that midfield. They have options already, perhaps. The main one, though, Fernandinho, 34, and the failed pursuits of Jorginho and Frankie de Jong suggest not only that they're already actively seeking another holding mid, but they also highlight something you touched on a minute ago, actually, that City aren't having it all their own way in the market. There's like probably about four or five examples of them going out there and trying and failing to sign one of Pep's top targets, Van Dijk being one that you mentioned, I think, a minute ago, Jorginho being another. De Jong, as I said a minute ago, is another. Alexis Sanchez. Although dodged a bullet there, you would have to say.
Man United seem to get the two ones that you were lucky you didn't get in the end, with Fred G as well.
Yeah, Fred too, and Riyad Mahrez, they took a while to sign. I think they tried to make a bid for January before they actually signed him.
And as well, quick note on that, he's their club record signing at 60 million odd. So they've not, for the volume they spent, their actual business, they're unwilling to spend 150 million on someone as of yet, or spend 90 million. But it's been many, if not plenty on one.
It's a dangerous game of City, though, isn't it? Because once they've shelled out a huge transfer fee, then the precedent is set that next time, if someone tries to sign sign a player, then it's, oh, well, you need to be paying that again.
It's clearly, as you've said there, something that they're actively seeking to avoid. The minute a player doesn't... it looks like a player is also interested by another club, Pep tends to go, right, no, I'm not going for you. You need to be absolutely committed to joining City.
I mean, isn't that there? He's going after Rodri, isn't he, to replace
£70 million release clause. It looks like it's going to be Rodri or Saunagay from Atletico.
Rodri would be a perfect handing glove. Yeah. Really, really good.
Both of those look like they probably would break the transfer record again. I think it's like 65
Rodri
million.
Rodri is 70 million, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Euros, I don't know what that would be in pounds, but yeah.
So that's basically how he takes them forward. The left-back question persists.
Yes.
But it sounds like Zinchenko has sort of, as I've said, I think I said last week, it sounds like he's convinced Pep Guardiola to avoid shelling out for another left-back, because you've obviously got Benjamin Mendy as well. Although
28 games since he played. 28 games for club and country since he joined Man City. Mm. Six trophies.
Nice work if you can get it.
Yeah. And that doesn't include the Carling, because he didn't play in the Carabao Cup last season. So if you're being generous, he's averaging a trophy every four appearances.
Well,
Thomas and Marlon, eat your heart out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But so that's like the how in a nutshell. Well, more than a nutshell. but I think the why is also interesting, because Guardiola is, and the why, I think, sort of highlights how Guardiola is operating on a completely different scale of ambition to any manager in world football right now. Because for him, he's learned this season, I think, that it's not just about winning titles, and with Man City, it's also not just about winning titles, playing great football, because that's what they've done. His stated ambition, and he's stated it enough times for you to see that it might even be becoming a bit of an obsession, is to make Man City a quote-unquote big club, with Liverpool and Manchester United being the two clubs that he sort of explicitly referred to a couple of times over the course of the previous season. And also, in the wake of their most recent title win, brought them up again. I think just before they wrapped up the title, he said that the media wants Liverpool to win the title, which is a bit chippy. And
it didn't go down well.
Perhaps a sign that he's losing the cool that... Well, actually, we don't associate a cool head with Guardiola, really.
No, he's shown the complete propensity to get, as you said, obsessed and sort of...
Intense
is the word I was looking for. He's
got a long fuse, but it's attached to a giant atomic bomb.
But so he mentioned Liverpool. He also mentioned Manchester United after they won the title, explicitly referring to the Mail Online, leading with a story about the abuse that Pogba copped from Manchester United fans rather than the Man City title win. I can't speak to the veracity of that claim. Maybe he was on the Man United page or something like that. But anyway, so this suggests that he's becoming frustrated. And I think the reason he's becoming frustrated is that to have achieved the level of unprecedented success that he has done, he's had to be a control freak. He's had to control absolutely everything. And the coverage of this unprecedented success is something that is completely beyond his control. And the winning the title, and obviously the reports that UEFA investigatory panel are going to recommend a Champions League ban for Man City's alleged breaches of FFP rules, has sort of polluted the coverage of their title, polluted from their sense, not in an objective sense, with questions about, with quite diminishing questions as to like the fact that they're spending more than their spending is rivaled only really by Manchester United among the big six, and also that in turn throws up questions over the ownership and their connections to human rights abuses, that is sort of the United Arab Emirates ownership, the ruling class. And these are conversations that can't be wholly separated from the on-field success Man City have enjoyed, but they're also importantly conversations that Guardiola can't control.
Yeah.
And his challenge really now is to answer the question as to how do you create legend and sort of like the emotion fueled memories of great clubs that we have for, say, the treble winning United side and I mean the Arsenal Invincibles even as well, but much more modern than that. How do you create that sense in an era of modern football where methods of success are so inexplicably linked with financial power and things that are quite scrutable and easy to sort of become a bit disillusioned by, which is not what you need when you're trying to create that kind of emotive legend surrounding a club.
I think the main thing is just jumping in, that he needs to win and keep winning. And then also, if you look at what made Chelsea, when Chelsea got taken over by Abramovich and he invested all that money into it, everyone was like, oh, new money, Chelsea got a history. And it was all pejorative stuff. Chelsea obviously have a long, long history, but they were never sort of renowned as like this juggernaut of English football that were top of the league all the time, were always in contention. And then they've become that under Abramovich because of the way they kept on winning titles and they lost titles and they had great rivalries. And that's what Pep needs more than winning titles, because Pep can win titles from his opinion. If there's no rivalry there, and everyone's like, yeah, so what? You've got the best team, you play the best football. Okay, good for you. And it's Man City, and people do struggle to care about Man City.
Yeah.
So what he needs is a rival. He needs his Joe Frazier. You know, if they're Muhammad Ali, he needs Joe Frazier. He needs Liverpool. He really does. I mean,
I can already see a graphic of Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola. Thriller in Manila.
Yeah, I mean,
Photoshop.
That's what this title race was. It was the thriller in Manila. They were beating the hell out of each other for the entire
season. Beating the hell out of everybody else in the league. Yes.
Mixed metaphors, isn't it? No, Guardiola needs a rival. He needs his nemesis. He needs his Darth Vader. He needs his Thanos. He needs his he needs an enemy.
I think the problem though is that because of, as I said, the media coverage.
Yeah,
he's becoming the Darth Vader. He's becoming the Thanos he's the figurehead of this club. And I actually think what helped Chelsea become grow a personality, really, if that makes any sense, is the sort of the villainy that was sort of
voiced upon them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. From all this big spending, and that's sort of happening to Man City right now.
In that case, he needs his rebellion, mate. He needs his Luke Skywalker. And who's more Han Solo than Jurgen Klopp? Let's just put that out there.
I think as well, it's people don't hate Chelsea as much now because things haven't gone their way. Yeah. When you have all the money and things are going your way, then that is exactly the time when people are going to bring up the sort of shady aspects of the money. So it was surprising when Guardiola sort of question the timing, because if there was a time that you're going to bring it up, when you're setting history is exactly when it needs to be part of the conversation.
It's like an athlete getting a drug test immediately after they've just like set a world record.
Yes, that's a good analogy.
You do it because it's like, hold on, no one's done that before. Let's just check. And obviously, the differences are there because there's clear in the accounts. There's clear evidence of the spending, and we know they're spending a lot of money. And where the money's coming from is obviously a massive sort of taboo subject.
Yeah. And the UEFA investigation, from what I discern from the reports, reached its conclusion or made its recommendation over the past week. So it's not like the journalists were sitting on this story and then broke it because they wanted to taint Man City's success. Right. It was a development that had just occurred.
Well, that was how the question was posed, wasn't it? It was like, we've not had an answer from this yet, because they'd been posing it to the club. Obviously, they would have been asking for statements. And that was an opportune moment to ask it, where the cameras are on and there's going to be evidence of what's being said and the reaction to it. But obviously, you can understand, as you've said there, Pep Guardiola is not necessarily in control of all that. He is the head coach of Manchester City. Mm. So you can understand why he's frustrated about not being asked about his coaching, but then they don't have anyone else to ask. So it's whole environment that...
It's football, right? It's elite level football. Everyone's got blood on their hands, right? There's no good owners. But you can't ultimately, even as like everyone is guilty, you can't ultimately look away from the things that Man City's owners have been accused of, both in terms of conjecture and supposition and what we have accounts of the way they treat migrant workers in their home country. And also, well, you really have evidence of what they've been doing financially with their football. So, it's I feel bad for Guardiola because it's like he's made this the best team in the world for the last 2 years, and all anyone talks about is how there can't be anyone in Europe, there can't be English teams in Europe, and the financial issues behind them. But ultimately, you know, it's the syndrome of the Messi syndrome. They're so good. It's like, what is there to say? You just say, yeah, they're amazing. What can you say about it?
And that's why the Liverpool will play a role in how well they're remembered, exactly. As well, as you said. And also, just a quick point on the Chelsea stuff. If you remember, and obviously we're in a time when social media, everyone's seeing stuff on Twitter and et cetera, and all of the stats that come out of it. Whenever we tweet about, oh, Man City have done this, but that still doesn't beat Chelsea's record, everyone's like, whoa, that Chelsea team were really good and like really... Not like, oh, it's because they spent loads of money. They're like, whoa, Chelsea went 90 home games unbeaten? Like, wow, sort of thing. So maybe time will be Pep's best friend in the sense that people will look back and be like, oh, wait, they've got 100 points.
they need rivalries. Mourinho, Chelsea's legend was really solidified because Man United rose up in opposition against them. Mm. That really sort of, because then Chelsea were fighting Man United for the title, and then fighting Liverpool as well in Europe and stuff. Mm. Yeah, City needs not just Liverpool. I mean, they need Liverpool, but they need someone else as well to sort of join the fray.
And as well, just a final point on that, I actually think that Chelsea success as well was accentuated by the All-English semi-finals and the All-English final as well. If you think about the night in Moscow and Man United winning that as well. So that for Man City is why it perhaps lessened, because they're not the English team in the final as well. They've not got that final against Liverpool, which would have been almost a mirroring of that Man United-Chelsea rivalry. Spurs have gone in, and that's the tainting, and perhaps Pep Guardiola's even more frustrated because of that. That Champions League is eluding them, and as you said, they're getting beaten by English teams as well, which they're clearly the best team in the land because they've just won every trophy possible.
Yes.
So the Man City complex is fascinating on and off the pitch, and obviously they retain the title, but we're going to take a little break and visit the other European top five leagues because everyone else retained the title as well, but we've picked out the stories that were slightly more interesting than the people that lift the trophy. So our first stop in the trip around Europe will be to the Bundesliga, which, as I said, and as we already know, was eventually retained by Bayern Munich. Their seventh consecutive title, which has never been done before in the German first division. The departure of Robbery, Frank Ribery and Arjen Robben both coming on in their final game to score in what was ending up being a convincing win to crown the title. Dortmund did push them all the way, had their own troubles in the second half of the season and fell off. But Sam, I'm passing over to you for the Bundesliga and you to tell us what you picked out as the major story of the season and just any other little tidbits that deserved a mention from what was an exciting Bundesliga season, really, and less dominant than before.
Yeah, so I think that the tale of the season definitely has to be Bayern's ageing machine just about managing to get the job done. As you say, they absolutely blasted the league last year, finished 21 points ahead of runners-up Schalke. But this year, Dortmund were back in business, had an excellent first half of the season with Sancho, Reus, everyone sort of playing really well. They took 42 points before the winter break, which helped them open up a 9-point lead as late as December. And at that stage, everyone was not only thinking Dortmund were going to do it, but also willing them to do it. I know we were. Yeah. I think most neutrals were. And the narrative seemed to be edging towards Bayern are falling off. Robben, Ribery leaving, Lewandowski's sort of powers waning. But in the second half of the season, back they came. I think the 5-0 victory in the Clásica proved to be really crucial. Both teams actually dropped points after that, so it wasn't like Bayern didn't flinch. Dortmund still had their chances, but just came up short. I think maybe showed a bit of naivety. But Kovac's men ended up nicking it by just 2 points. Their seventh title in a row. And that reminds me a bit of Gary Lineker's famous quote on football is a simple game. Everyone runs around for 90 minutes and the Germans always win.
Yeah.
It feels like the Bundesliga at the moment is 18 teams chase the ball for 34 games and Bayern Munich always win.
Yeah.
It's just a real sense of inevitability about it. After Dortmund lost to Schalke during the run-in, the Dortmund boss declared that the title race was over. And that was unbelievable. Okay, they played a game more, but they were still only a point behind.
Yeah.
If you think that in the Premier League, you would never say it was over. But yeah, so Bayern had the oldest team in the league this year. Average of the players used was 27.7.
Prime years.
But it to me, it just feels like everyone, not just Dortmund, really missed the chance this season to get in there before Bayern really start that rebuild. Obviously, they've said they're going to sign a lot of players this summer.
I mean, yeah, they've got Lucas Hernandez and Pavard coming in, two 22-year-old World Cup winners. They've got Kingsley Coman and Sergio Gnabry both scored, or not both scored, but they both played parts in goals at the weekend. They're both 23 and 24, I think. They've got Tolisso. They've got so many good young players. I mean, like you said, this was Dortmund's shot. They might win it for the next 5 years.
Although you'd argue that because that massive real rebuild is coming, this was your best chance, and then next season will be the next best chance you get for a while. Because bringing it, if you're completely rebuilding your defence, despite Pavard and Hernandez knowing each other very well, there's a lot of French players in that team starting to build in there anyway, with Coman and Tolisso mentioned. Jan Fiete Arp, who is sort of the German poster boy of the youth teams, is confirmed this morning that he'd already been signed from Hamburg, and he had a choice to join this season or next summer, and it looks like he's taking the option to join this season. An interesting striker in itself, an incredible youth record, and his idol is Harry Kane, which again is just showing the age of everyone else at the moment when someone's idolising a 26-year-old, I think, England striker. So Bayern next season, it looks like it will be the rebuild. As you said, they almost got away with their really old team. But Lewandowski, who we had a conversation about before one of the Champions League ties, about should they replace him, is this the end? He finished as top scorer again with 22 goals, which is obviously not as many as you usually see in the Bundesliga, obviously the same tally as the Premier League Golden Boot winners. But there seems to be more clusters of goal scorers in these leagues now. So although Bayern Munich won that league, the second top scorer was Paco Alcacer, who was the sort of freak substitute for Dortmund in the season. They made that move permanent. He scored 18 goals and over half of them were a sub. I think he was the first sub ever to score 10 as a substitute in a Bundesliga season. And then you have Kramaric, Jovic, Marco Reus, Kai Havertz and Wout Weghorst on 17. And it was Wolfsburg who won 8-1 on the final day.
Yeah, Weghorst only got there right at the end, didn't he?
And the final day of the season was actually, I think it was the most goals in a match day for over 10 years. And they won 8-1 to secure a Europa League place. Eintracht Frankfurt, who were beaten by Bayern Munich, and obviously went far in the Europa League this season.
They had an awful end to the finish. They didn't win a game after they qualified for the semi-finals. I think they finished with 3 straight defeats and took just 2 points from their final 6 games. Ended up finishing 7th.
And that was after securing the signature of Jovic from their buyout clause from Benfica. But I think that's a good point to mention him. If we're talking about the stars of that Bundesliga season, no one in that Bayern Munich team really was like, oh, you were really good. As we said, Lewandowski won the Golden Boot. You had the likes of Ribéry and Robben playing their final season.
Coman had flashes.
Yeah, Coman had flashes, but injured.
And I suppose Thiago is probably the one.
Yeah, an important season for Serge Gnabry. I think that will be his first title, won't it? So.
I think he was there last season, wasn't he, for Bayern Munich? Anyway, maybe not. I might have been mixed on the loans, but what I was going to say is if it wasn't, he's scored 10 goals in all 3 of his Bundesliga seasons now, showing that real consistency and showing Arsenal what they're missing. But Luka Jovic, as I said, in that sort of top scorers list, is probably not the most exciting. Maybe Kai Havertz, the most goals by a teenager in a Bundesliga season. More history made there. But Luka Jovic, as we said, is going to be at the front of everyone's mind this summer, because Frankfurt activated the buyout clause for about €8 million from Benfica because he hadn't played, 21 years old. This season, you're now seeing reports of a €60 million, €70 million bid from the likes of Real Madrid for someone that his first 25 Bundesliga goals were split perfectly. 5 with his head, 10 with his left foot, 10 with his right foot. So if you want to buy a striker that scores goals, he looks like the man to do it, Sam.
Yeah, definitely. I think everyone is going to be after him this summer. Real Madrid, I could see that happening as well. But also as well, I wouldn't completely rule out Bayern Munich going for him. Yeah. I know we're talking about Lewandowski not being past it, but they do like to pick the sort of cream of the crop from the rest of the league.
Yeah, but I think the price they put on his head is going to... Bayern don't like to spend massive amounts of money. They prefer to, like you said, just ruthlessly poach the rest of the Bundesliga. With Jovic, they've missed the mark. Like 70 million, 80 million. I think they've said they don't want to spend... Well, they spent that on Lucas Hernandez. I think they don't want to spend anything around that kind of much again. I mean, maybe they'll break the bank, but I
think they probably need to spend close to that, because if they're going to replace Ribben, Robbery.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Robbery have been replaced, I think, internally already by Gnabry and Coleman. I think that's
Alphonso Davies.
They've got players who can play in those roles, and you know, maybe this now falls more into Thomas Müller as well. Obviously, he had a struggle for the first half of the season, but I think Jovic is a really, really, like, really interesting striker, because it's like Jake said, he's very balanced, can score left, right or head. He's really accurate. He scores unorthodox finishes. He reminds me of Luis Suarez. I've said it before. That's why I thought Barca should go for it. That's why they were linked with him for a long time. He's very much like, he takes a lot of early shots, a lot of instinctive shots. You're thinking, what are you doing? Oh, wait, it's a goal. Well done. You know, so, and he's 20, 21. He's very young. Lots of room to grow. I think if Madrid have identified him, it's clear that they're either thinking of, oh, poor Karim Benzema, we're going to play you again, or... we've discussed on it off air, playing them together maybe in that diamond formation. I mean, Jovic is a goal scorer. Real Madrid need a goal scorer. I mean, his shot conversion rate for this season was 27.78 in the Europa League with 10 goals, and in the Bundesliga it was 22.08. So he scores goals at a decent clip.
Well, Rebic celebrates every time he shoots. I mean, that viral image that went around.
I mean, yeah, that sums it up really. The fact that he got put through on goal and Rebic was celebrating just tells you how much of a gunner this guy actually is. I mean, He could be very special.
So Luka Jovic, one of many exciting talents in the Bundesliga that probably won't be there that next season. And also just a word on Serge Gnabry. He did not play for Bayern Munich last season. It feels like he's been in the Bundesliga for ages, so I apologise for getting that wrong. But we will leave the Bundesliga there with that correction from myself. Take another little mini break, and then we'll be heading to our Serie A expert, Will Hall, for a review of some Calcio football. So as I said, now we're heading over to Italy, where Juventus won their 8th consecutive title, outdoing Bayern Munich in the Bundesliga and setting a record for the first team to do it ever in one of Europe's top 5 leagues. But Juventus, as I said, we know what happened. Ronaldo moving there, wanting to win the Champions League with them. We knew Serie A title was in the bag, really. Napoli came closest last season with 90 points. But fallen away under Ancelotti. But there's one team that have been fascinating in Serie A this season, and I know Will is desperate to speak about them. So I'll be handing straight over to him for a little lesson on one of Serie A's most intriguing teams from 2018-19.
Right, so firstly, apology accepted for the grabby thing. Secondly, thanks to the Serie A expert shout, I've now come down with a case of imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
But without question for me, third place, Atalanta, is the story of the 2018-19 Serie A season. They have in their hands the chance to compete in their first ever Champions League tournament, or indeed European Cup tournament. Had they won the Coppa Italia final against Lazio last week, you could make a pretty strong case, in which, by the way, they were denied a penalty. You could make a pretty strong case this is the golden era of Atalanta history. For context, current manager Giampiero Gasperini took over in 2016 and has made the top 4 in his first season in charge, top 7 in his second season in charge. And three things to say on this. This was before fourth place in Serie A got you Champions League. That came in, I think, last season. Or no, this season, in fact. But they did finish with 72 points back then, which is higher than the 69-point maximum I think they can earn this season. Which will get them third, which will guarantee them third, because they'll be ahead of Inter Milan head-to-head. I'll do a bit of a state of play later. This is significant because they're historically a yo-yo club. And in this current spell in Serie A, with the first two seasons, I think, of which were blighted by points deductions in relation to the more recent of the Italian football's betting scandals. But they always finished outside the top 10 before Gasperini took over. He led them to that top 4 finish, but then they lost a raft of their best young talent, mostly to the Milan clubs, so it would be particularly satisfying to finish above both of those. So you had players like Roberto Gagliardini, went to Inter, Andrea Conti, AC Milan. This all happened in 2017, by the way. Mm-hmm. Frank Kessie went to AC Milan. Mattia Caldara went to Juve, but then I think was involved in that swap deal for Bonucci, so did end up at Milan. But this season, they are one of like three teams, three surprise packages that really stayed the course in terms of vying for those top four Champions League places. The others were Sassuolo, who actually they finish, who will probably finish outside the top 10, and they and Atalanta will finish their campaign at home to Sassuolo. The other was Sampdoria's top scorer, Fabio Quagliarella, with 26 goals. Is leading the race to win at the Capocannoniere.
Capocannoniere.
Don't call me a Serie A expert for nothing.
Yeah.
So pretty much.
That'll be the first Sampdoria Golden Boot since Vialli, and only the third in their history.
He's also, I think, equaled the record, Gabriel Batistuta's record this season for scoring in 11 consecutive Serie A games on the bounce.
Jamie Vardy of Serie A.
And
he's 36.
That's a horrible thing to say, Sam.
which I don't think makes him the oldest ever Italian Golden Boot winner, but he's the oldest player to have scored so many goals.
Yeah, Luca Toni was goals. The oldest.
Yeah, Luca Toni, I think, for Hellas Verona.
Season.
Yeah. So, before going to the state of play, why are Atalanta so cool?
Yeah.
His five reasons.
And they're blue and black, right? That's a
they score a lot of goals and take risks defensively. You probably have heard them compared to Ajax over the course of this season. There are other reasons for that, which I'll come on to later. But they basically have more goals than any other Serie A team, 74. And in fact, only one team in Europe's top five leagues has scored more away goals than their 41 this season. And Sam, I'm disappointed in you because that team is Hoffenheim.
Oh,
it should have been
mate.
The story of the Bundesliga campaign. Mate. I'm joking, they definitely weren't. the story of
Reece Nelson's Hoffenheim.
Yeah. The other thing that Atalanta have this season is the sort of the course of their campaign, unlike say Man City, has a sort of easily discernible arch to it. Because like Ajax, they started it in July with the Europa League qualifiers, so it's been a long old season. And also, and after starting it by beating Frosinone 4-0 on the first day, I think they failed to win any of their next seven Serie A games. So they had to overcome some level of adversity there to get back on track. Reason number three that makes them such a cool, basically the hipster club at the moment.
Oh, he said it.
Is that they play with a back three. And they have a very interesting front three.
Since when was back three hipster nowadays?
True, actually. I'm thinking back to the sort of Conte era. Pre-Conte era. But anyway, go with this.
Gasperini's been the originator of the back three, to be fair to him. He's been doing it for a long time.
Okay, there we go.
There you go.
But they have a really cool front three. Is essentially what I was trying to get onto. Yeah. Right, cold figure. Alejandro Gomez, also known as Papu Gomez, is captain. He stayed when he could have gone in 2017, signed a new deal, and has been like their consistent force. He's basically the player who's defined this era more than anyone else. He has, in fact, this season created more chances with 109 than any other player in Europe's top five leagues. They also have like a supremely gifted yet often frustrating mercurial maverick in Josip Iličić, who scored in last night's 1-1 draw with Juventus. He's completed the second most dribbles in the league this season, 77, which is made all the more impressive by the fact that Fiorentina fans used to call him Lurch due to his gangly appearances. That has to be mentioned, it was probably one of those affectionate things, although like I said, he was quite a frustrating player for them. So
he's the really odd person. If we're talking about Harry Maguire carrying the ball out, Josip Iličić, he's about 6'3", isn't he?
Yeah, he's also odd in the sense that like Gasperini is said to demand a lot in terms of work rate from his players. Yet he is, like I said, one of those kind of mercurial wingers who like is blown hot and cold throughout his career. He has like an absurd level of talent and technical ability, but you never know whether he's going to actually use it again. The other player who has to be mentioned is Duvan Zapata, whose previous best goal tally for a single season, I think, was 11. This season, he's outscoring Cristiano Ronaldo with 22 goals. And only Lionel Messi, across Europe's top five leagues, has more goals away from home than he's this season with 15.
The most unwelcome of guests it seems, in Serie A, Zapata. Mm. Away goals. I thought that was quite clever.
It was a slow burner.
Also, just a little point on Gomez. He is the man as well, the captain that was worn frozen armbands.
He went for a phase of just having a different design on his armband. I think there was one with like a PlayStation, there was one with a Pope on it.
We once did a video, because again, as you said, he's defined this era and he's always been top of those chance creations. And we did a little video on all of the captain's armbands that he's used. And he also has that little fun dance as well that you can get as like a gift on Twitter. So he's like one of the most likable players. So it's so cool to see him doing well.
Like, when I had cult figure, I really do mean it. He's like, he's a player with like just heaps of personality, and that personality shows itself. So just sort of two more reasons, by the way. I promise you five. Yeah. This is number four. They're famous for their youth academy. So this is another part of the parallels people are drawing with Ajax. Famous ex-Atalanta academy players younger listeners probably won't be familiar with include like Gaetano Scirea, who's considered one of the greatest defenders of all time, obviously Baresi and people like Maldini are a bit more sort of like well known among us because they're a little bit more modern, but he's like one of the all-time greats in terms of defenders. There's also Roberto Donadoni, who was part of the AC Milan side managed by Sacchi in the 1980s. And more recently, you've had Gianpaolo Pazzini, Riccardo Montolivo, and Giacomo Bonaventura, who both of whom, interestingly, sort of ended up at AC Milan. But Montolivo, I think, is leaving after
swapping a red stripe for a blue stripe.
Yeah, their youth system is regarded still as among the best in Italy. And as I've said, they produced all those players that were left in 2017.
And the under-20 World Cup squad is dominated by Atalanta players.
But they're producing them, but they're also sort of signing them because they're quite clever in terms of like spotting these gems. But their youth system is regarded as among the best in Italy. In 2014, placed among the top 10 across Europe, or might be in the world actually, according to one of those CIES football observatory studies, which I think looked at the appearances the youth products of the Atalanta youth system would go on to make at top level. And as I touched on a minute ago, like Southampton or Ajax, teams like that, they combine this youth academy that supplies players for the first team with an eye for uncovering these like hidden gems in the transfer market or taking risks, these sort of curveball signings. You would have to say Ilicic is probably one of those. I don't think many people expected his output in terms of assists and goals. I think he's got like double figures for assists, I'm pretty sure, this season. Because of, as the reasons I gave earlier, he's a quite frustrating figure. And they in the past signed some pretty iconic names who players who joined their team before getting what you would consider to be the biggest move of their career were like Filippo Inzaghi and Christian Vieri, and more recently, as I've said, they made the signings of Ilicic, Gomez and Zapata, all of whom are like sort of late 20s when they bought them, but they comprise the front three right now that is basically sort of like firing them to success.
So this has been a history of Atalanta in the 2018-19
review. So now to the actual like the modern bit. This is the state of play. Will they make the Champions League? They're currently, as I said, it's in their hands on 66 points. Pelé Sassuolo at home on the final day. So all they have to do really is match the results of Inter and Milan. Inter are on the same points as them, but obviously Serie A is decided by head-to-head and they have the advantage in that sense over Inter. Milan have a head-to-head advantage over Atalanta, but that only really comes into play if they draw and Atalanta lose, I think. AC Milan play Spal on the final day, which is probably a game you'd expect them to win.
Spal were 11th, looking at it.
Yeah, but I mean, those mid-table teams right at the end of the season, you don't know if they're going to be that incentivised. Whereas Inter Milan, I think, play Empoli, who were in a bit of a relegation scrap. So they perhaps are playing the opponent that has the most to lose in that game. You've also got Roma kind of in with a shout, but they would require an almighty goal difference swing because I think they've like drawn in terms of head-to-head with two teams that could replace.
Yeah. Well, Torino made a little late surge, didn't they? With Andrea Belotti, the 2016-17 transfer.
Yeah.
The 2016-17 Luka Jovic.
I think Torino would have got like Europa League had Atalanta won the Coppa Italia final.
Lazio are in eighth and have a little mark next to them for Europa League next season. So, Atalanta, do you think they will make it? They'll Champions League? It's boiled down to this one decision.
I tell you what, actually. So I've made a conscious decision now to
because I
always buy an Atalanta shirt.
But yeah, when I make predictions, I always try and counter jinx it and predict for the thing I don't want to happen. Mm. But now I'm going to change that and predict the thing I want to happen and try and make a logical case for it. So I think that Atalanta will finish third, because basically at the moment, like, there's no one else in Serie A in better form than they are. They obviously drew with Juventus last night. I think had they won it, that would have been like 6 or 7 wins on the bounce, basically. So they're the form team, really, in Serie A. So you'd expect them to go and beat a Sassuolo side with nothing to play for, really. So I think they'll make it. But then it's just a question of whether they get picked apart like they always do.
Well, as you said, though, because they haven't got necessarily that young base, and it is all of these forgotten heroes that are walking down the dusty road and finding themselves at Atalanta and then turning into the world beater that everyone thought they could be, not many people are going to maybe want to sign Duvan Zapata for £40 million when he's not got much left and stuff like that. So yes, they might be able to, they might be lower fees because they're not great, but being in the Champions League with Atalanta, as you said, the atmosphere at the club seems very positive. Gomez has already stayed. He's like 31, so he's not going to move on really anyway now. So it would be great to see Atalanta and Gomez's frozen captain's armband in the Champions League next season.
And the way they scout, to be honest, with the Champions League money, they could do a lot of good things with the way they look for deals and everything. So,
and as well, just as you said, their youth academy to bolster the squad if they're going to need a longer campaign, they have all the tools to be sort of a surprise package, not just in Serie A this season, but in the Champions League next season.
It's about what, I mean, they've probably become acclimatised to the system of sort of high turnover of players and us, and perhaps I've heard suggestions from other experts.
For real conference call.
They might look to sell as a patter, actually, because...
Yeah, well, you would make most of it, but you wouldn't put it past them to all of a sudden pluck another striker that will turn his 11-goal season best, as I think you mentioned, into 22. Yeah.
There's one of the young Fiorentina players, I think. It might have been Simeone or...
Chiesa. They'll be able to sign someone, but we will leave Serie A there after Will's incredible overview of Atalanta's history and season in 2018-19. If you haven't watched Atalanta, tune in for the final day and see if they can secure that Champions League. But next, we will be heading towards, and then we can call Mers La Liga expert, I think, because he manages to link every other point he makes towards La Liga. So that's coming up for you next. So our next stop in Europe's top five leagues is, as I mentioned, La Liga, with Barcelona and Lionel Messi dominating, really, this season. Barcelona finishing 19 points ahead of Real Madrid, but Atletico Madrid got into second place. And we know everyone loves listening to Mo for his Barcelona knowledge and analysis and everything, but we get quite a lot of nice podcasts. So, yes, of course, you can mention them. They are title winners.
Am I loud?
But we've been, you were briefed beforehand to stray into other realms from La Liga this season, because there have been plenty of other little nice stories that I've noticed. And if you don't mention them, I'll make you talk about them anyway. But as I said, without further ado, over to you, Mo, for your La Liga roundup.
I mean, yeah, look, La Liga has been absolutely wild this year. There's been enough narratives and stories to make their own cinematic universe. You know, it's been so much stuff going on. I mean, so yes, look, Barcelona.
He's just going to talk about the Avengers.
to get it out of the way, yes, Barcelona La Liga, Messi was amazing, top of basically every metric that matters, goals, assists, shots, chances created, big chances created, everything, except for take-ons completed, where Sofiane Boufal beat him to it.
Southampton do it again.
Mate, Southampton. Yeah, Southampton always are doing the business. Messi was second, but by 10. But that's one narrative. Yeah, that Messi care Barcelona, Piqué was good, whatever, right? There's much more interesting stories elsewhere in the league. For starters, Valencia made the Champions League with 16 draws. That's just like, they started the season, they couldn't buy a win, and ended the season kind of in a rough way, because after Arsenal slapped them around in the Europa League. But they've managed to get themselves into the Champions League ahead of everyone's favourite team, all of a sudden, Getafe. You're talking about weird hipster clubs. I mean, Getafe are so boring, they weren't even hipster enough to be hipster. Like, but everything they've done this season has been pure hipster gold. Like, they've come from nowhere. Bordalas has been there since 2016. He's made them into this ferocious defensive outfit. They have the joint second best defensive record in the league with 35 goals conceded. Same as Valencia, actually. They lost out on the Champions League just literally on the penultimate day of the season, and it's frustrating, but you know, he's turned them into this beast of a team. Like, they're really hard to play against. They don't give you an inch. You know, Jenny Dekonam in defence is an absolutely incredible defender. The whole team is really good, but he is by far the standout. Arsenal have been linked with him, and you can see why, because, I mean, you know, if you ever have someone screamed, I mean, look, remember Laurent Koscielny for years was an amazing defender for Arsenal, didn't necessarily dominate or organise the defence that well, but was just, as a defender, the defending, hashtag defending, that's what Jenny is like. He's just incredible. Physically, technically, mentally, everything. He's brilliant. So that's a real good story. Another probably tragic story for Jake and myself, who tipped them to do very well this season, is Atletico Madrid just being absolutely, just every chance they had to put pressure on Barcelona, they just shot themselves in the foot. They had their most stacked squad possibly ever. Just an array of talent. They thought, this is it. They're going to do it. They won the Europa League. Griezmann finally got the final hoodoo off his back. He scored in finals. He won the World Cup. They're going to go for it. They've got the best squad in La Liga. Barcelona's coach is still a weirdo. They're going to go for it. But no, they never put their foot down. You know, they had these runs, but they just, it looks like it's basically the end of an era. It's all come at once. So at the end of the season, they're losing now so many players. Godin is leaving. Juanfran is leaving. Felipe Luis is leaving. That's three of his preferred back four, really. Mm. Which is weird, because honestly, Felipe Luis and Arias are not... I'm sorry, Felipe Luis and Juanfran are not good fullbacks anymore. But, you know...
It's that sort of Simeone spirit that they have embedded in them. Yeah. And Koke's even come out and said, hasn't he? Said, they're leaving, but I will make sure... Yeah. Everyone else that joins knows what it takes to play for Atletico Madrid.
I mean, it's a big onus on Koke now, because he's now basically, Gabby's left and those guys left, Godin is left. He's the big dog now in the yard. He's the one the most experienced. He's the most, he's the veteran. Him and Oblak have to step up, because they're going to lose Griezmann as well. He's announced he's not staying. Is he going to Barcelona? Is he going to Bayern and PSG? Who knows? But he's not staying at Atletico Madrid, that's for sure. And they've already talking like, they've been talking about, like, he's dead to them already. They're already like, go away, you don't care.
Well, the reports were that they made him do that announcement to avoid another documentary.
He wanted a documentary, and it's like they're just sitting there like some hostage hair all messed up and t-shirt. I'm leaving, I love Atletico Madrid, bye. And I mean, they've been linked with the likes of Dybala.
Yeah, I know.
So I mean, this is one thing I can say about Atletico Madrid. When it comes to forwards, they will never hurt for forwards. They will, if they lose them, they'll get them back.
Always.
Their list of strikers is incredible. They will get, I'm almost certain they'll get Dybala, who seems to apparently be on the outs of events, because he's worth a lot of money and doesn't really get on with their big number seven. So they want to get him out. But then, I mean, that's a huge win if you're Atletico. But I mean, even then, they're going to lose Rodri. They might lose Saul. They might lose Thomas Partey. They're just going to lose most of their team.
We didn't play Partey much anyway.
But I mean, he's still came out very big for them in key moments.
And if you're going to lose Saul and Rodri, you wanted Partey to be there.
I mean, look, like I said, their team next season is going to be Oblak, Jimenez, Koke, and then Morata. That's literally from their starting lineup. That's basically who they've got for next season. Thomas Lemar, who didn't really settle in. But I mean,
That was an odd sign. Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, Atletico Madrid, with all the moves they were making, it was one of their sort of biggest summers in quite a while. You thought, Juventus had some good targets.
They're usually good in recruitment, though. So I think and Lemar, I think Simeone, it can take time to get it. I think if Lemar gets it in the summer, which, I mean, he's shown every capacity to be a great player. We know this. I think he'll do well. And maybe he'll get a more central role anyway if Griezmann doesn't get replaced directly. Maybe, you know, so we'll see. But Atletico just buckling. It's going to be such a different team. But I think this is the real thing. Diego Simeone won La Liga with Atletico Madrid. That's full stop, great, one of the greatest coaches ever. This is interesting. I see, can he rebuild them? But moving across town, for the third Madrid side of the update, Real Madrid, I mean, the story about them is they're rubbish, basically. They're just absolutely terrible. They brought Zidane back and they're still rubbish. You know, he's brought Marcelo back in from the cold, made his son the backup goalkeeper. They're going to boot out Keylor Navas. It's just a disaster. It's everything that seemed to work for Zidane in his first run. It's like, he just has nothing. There's no mojo. Can't motivate any of the players to do anything. Santi Solari had a bigger new manager bump when he showed up. You know,
well, I think the thing is, when Zidane did turn up, they did still have nothing to play for.
Yeah, I mean, it was so weird for them to do it. Like, at that point, surely you just let Solari ride out the season. There's no point in
I know it hasn't gone well. They were probably fearful that it was going to be even worse. So 12 defeats in the league they've had 12 defeats on a few occasions, but they've only ever had 13 once. So it was a bad season. I think it was that they lost 19 games across all competitions.
They're awful.
They lost 8 games at home.
They're 17 points behind Barcelona. last season, but they won the Champions League, so everyone sort of forgot that. They were terrible last year. They had like 4 good games in Europe, 5 good games in Europe, and that was enough for them. And this year, they didn't have that. And they've just been...
And not Ronaldo, as you said, looking to replace the goal scorer.
That's why they want Luka Jovic. Yeah. Because when Benzema's had a couple of very good runs in which Marco christened him the best number 9 in the world.
Well, the thing is he finished joint second top scorer behind Messi.
Yeah.
With Suarez on 21.
He's done well. And this is the thing with Benzema. It's like, he can do that. He can do that level. But if you're Real Madrid, you need a bit more.
You need 2.
You need two. And so maybe that's why they want Luka Jovic. And... You know, they need to rebuild the side. Obviously, they're going for Hazard. That's all but that, like, open secret. That's basically going to happen now, whether or not it's confirmed yet or not, obviously. And their rumours is they want Pogba, but now they want Eriksen. They want a midfielder, essentially, which is weird because they just renewed Toni Kroos for, like, 5 years. Yeah. He's clearly on the downslope. It's like, huh?
Well, we were saying about that company... Sorry, Zan.
That must be Zidane's call, though.
Yeah, so, no, obviously. Look at Marcelo coming back in. And their rumours is they're now going to look for a left-back to try and push Reguilon out of the club, even though Reguilon is one of their youth products and looked like he'd die for the shirt and was one of their best players when he was playing under Solari. So
seems like the French influence, because Mendy is the one that's...
Furlong Mendy is great. He's a phenomenal fullback, but it just seems like if Marcelo is your favourite person, which clearly he is, Zidane loves Marcelo, and rightfully so. Marcelo's amazing, and one of the greatest fullbacks of all time. But you know, Reguilón looks like a perfect, not perfect, but a good replacement. Yeah, solid guy. But yeah, and it's just Madrid is disaster after disaster. They finished terribly, but they've got a big summer ahead of them. They could easily just buy their way back into contention. But the story of the season, just to come to it all now, is Iago Aspas. Yeah. More than any of those. That's all preamble, frankly. That's your Thor the Dark World.
That's a long preamble.
That's your Avengers Infinity War. That's your Captain Marvel, Black Panther, Thor. Right now, this is your end game right here. Iago Aspas, absolutely. I mean, look, he's scored 10 goals in his first 18 games of the season, and Celta were doing all right. Nothing magic. He got injured, and while he was injured, Celta won once, drew once, and lost 8 games. They plummeted down the table. They were awful. He even came back for one game in the middle of this injury spell and was rubbish and came off the bench and they lost that game as well. Yeah. Just absolutely terrible. He came back, Celta was staring relegation dead in the face. They looked dead and buried. Maxi Gomez went from being linked with Barcelona to being linked with West Ham, if you want to see how far he fell. They look finished. It looked like they were over. Maxi Gomez... Iago Aspas has gone on a rampage. One-man army. Since he came back into La Liga... He's played 9 games. He's scored 10 goals, which is the most in the league in that time. Created 7 big chances, most in the league in that time. 3 assists, which is not the most, but that's because he's playing with people who aren't.
Because he's scoring the goals.
Yeah. And his shot conversion is 45.45%, which is the most in the league in that time for players with more than 10 shots. Like, he's a one-man army. Celta scored, 17 goals, and he scored like 13 of them. Mm. He scored or assisted 13 of them. He's been... 76% of their goals since he came back. He's made them. He's pulled them out of the fire. They only lost once, and that was the penultimate game of the week with Aspas in the side. They lost twice. One game he was suspended for, they lost that, and they lost the penultimate game of the season. They drew with Rio on the last day of the season. He scored both the goals, of course. He's been absolutely incredible. So the emotion he's been, the thing is, he's not been doing it like in a sort of like a classic English sort of stoic man.
Yeah.
He's been crying the whole time. The emotion has been clear. He's been wearing his heart on his sleeve. He loves Celta Vigo. You know, he was so bad for Liverpool. Everyone remembers him of that. But he's
he's come a long way since that corner.
He was great for Celta Vigo, and then he went to Liverpool. And sometimes players have to play for their hometown club. You know, Matt Le Tissier could never do it for England, even though he's an amazing talent. But for Saints, he was amazing. And he never moved to a big club because he was happy there. Alan Shearer, to a lesser degree, obviously. But he shunned big moves to Man United to go to his hometown club. Sometimes you can't pay a price on being a local hero. Iago Aspas is Celta Vigo. He is a local hero. He's kept them up single-handedly this season. He's getting on now, but I would like to have one more great season out of him. You know,
he scored 22 goals last season as well in Serie A, so he's ending strong. And Luis Enrique seems to be willing to include these heroes in his Spain squad.
I mean, look, with Spain don't exactly have a great selection of strikers, to be honest. Like, there's Morata, who seems to have issues. Paco Alcácer has only really got off the bench.
Yeah.
Who do you start? You know, so I mean, Aspas is genuinely one of the best Spanish strikers, so why not pick him?
Aspas and Santos. Santi Cazorla in the Spain squad?
I mean,
I was just about to say Santi
because he's another nice story.
Santi is another great story, but honestly,
Real stayed up, didn't they?
I don't think I could go through Santi's story without crying. So I just it's genuinely emotional. Like, the man thought he'd never walk again, let alone play football again. And then they unveiled the best part was this: they unveiled him at the Madrigal with a magic show. And his performances that season were magic. If you watched him against Barcelona in that 4-4 draw, 4-5 win or whatever, to Barcelona, incredible.
He is.
Incredible. I'm not going to go anymore because it genuinely will make me emotional.
He is a magician. And I think leaving it on those two brilliant little footballers will be the best for that La Liga roundup there. I hope you enjoyed that and I hope you kept up with that because that was serious information. And now we're going to the final one, which will be everyone's favourite league, Ligue 1. Last but not least on our tour of Europe's top five league is Ligue 1, as I said, so often called a farmers league, and for no reason at all, apart from the fact it produces the best players. I'm going to be talking about Ligue 1, if you've missed my voice in the podcast, so get ready, strap in. And obviously, I feel like I've picked out three little stories for you, and I'm going to start with what is the most bizarre of them all, which was Monaco nearly being relegated. Everyone remembers that incredible side with the likes of Mbappe, Bernardo Silva, Thomas Lemar, who we mentioned, Fabinho, all the other clubs in Europe now. But Monaco this season had to wait until the penultimate day to secure their place in Ligue 1 next season. And this is after a complete debacle in which Leonardo Jardim, who won Manager of the Year and won that Ligue 1 title, was fired at the beginning of the season. And then Thierry Henry was appointed manager. And now it was the return of the prodigal son with Thierry Henry. Everyone thought this will be it, his chance. Monaco's golden boy and arguably their most famous product until Mbappe wins about seven more World Cups. Henry was the man to lead them out of this relegation fight. However, it was probably the worst possible job he could have taken because Monaco this season have made 18 signings overall, including the winter, plus five loan deals, but they lost 17 games. And Thierry Henry came in and had a record of played 12, won 2, drawn 3 and lost 7 in Ligue 1. And they went further and closer to relegation when he came in the team. But it wasn't just on the pitch that was the most interesting thing about Monaco this season. It was Henry's experience of being a manager that had so many weird contradictions in it in itself. It was arguably worse than Gary Neville's experience at Valencia. Thierry Henry came in and immediately had problems delivering his instructions to the Monaco players. Alexander Golovin, the man that was linked with Chelsea during the World Cup with Russia, after Henry was replaced by Jardim again, said that he became visibly and actively frustrated at his inability of certain players to do what he was asking them to do. And I quite liked the quote that saying that he found it difficult to transition from being the fun assistant manager to the coach with everything on his shoulders. Obviously at Belgium, his success with getting the best out of Romelu Lukaku and Eden Hazard was visible in his friendly relationship off the pitch. But he came to Monaco, became a manager and realised how difficult it really is. The culmination of which, in a 5-1 defeat to Strasbourg, he was moaning a lot about the time wasting of right back Kenny Lala, who was named in Ligue 1 team of the season, a very impressive campaign and someone that will likely be plucked, as I said, from the market that is Ligue 1. And he said, and it's a French slur, so it translates probably more horribly than it actually is, but he on the touchline was seen as calling, and this has been done by lip readers, calling Kenny Lala's grandmother a whore on the touchline. So Thierry Henry in Ligue 1 this season, despite only 20 games in charge, had a complete explosion, and probably if baptism of fire does not do Monaco's season and his season in charge of Monaco justice.
I mean, yeah, it was just such a weird decision, wasn't it, to go there in the first place? Like you said, they were in free fall. They needed someone, a steady hand, someone who could just keep them up, because Henry went there with all this optimism, like, I'm going to play Pep Guardiola football. Like, but you're not playing with players on that level, or maybe the young players, but...
And even though the thing about saying all these Pep Guardiola football, he pretty much implemented the Belgium tactics.
Yeah.
And that is built on sort of that counter-attack, and we saw in the World World Cup with Kevin De Bruyne being deployed as a false nine sometimes. Henry was criticised for changing his tactics so much and actually putting out quite defensive teams. And they scored 10 goals during his time at Ligue 1 in those 12 games and conceded 27. So this Monaco team that were 2 years ago beating Pep Guardiola's Man City in the Champions League with the likes of Mbappe, Bernardo Silva, Thomas Lemar, Falcao scored 15 goals again, which probably helped keep them up, the captain that he is, El Tigre. But this was probably one of the most bizarre seasons in one of Europe's top leagues. For someone, for a team in Monaco that had been praised so often for their recruitment strategy, their ability to sell players and replace them well, and the owners of the club admitted that their recruitment was completely wrong. Cesc Fabregas obviously joined in the winter window because he was replaced by Sarri's son, to quote him, at Chelsea. But then Henri, one of the main reasons why Fabregas joined, left. He obviously stayed with the club and helped keep them up. But this whole Monaco season as a microcosm was complete chaos. And the only good thing about it is that they managed to stay up, and it looks like they should be able to rebuild in a better place. Whether Jardine continues again will be the question in
itself.
They'll
make a lot of money off Youri Tielemans as well.
On the subject of money, according to France Football report in April, Thierry Henry, and this might be to do with tax reasons in Monaco, was the third best paid manager in the world, earning more money than Pep Guardiola.
And I read that the payoff to get rid of him was £10 and £15 million. So that in itself, as I said, that Monaco season is one of the strangest stories of Ligue 1, in a side that has failed to do anything at all, and one that had been so good so many years ago. But one team that is almost the complete opposite of that is Lille. And they've secured second place. They're in the Champions League next season. Everyone knows and has heard probably of Nicolas Pepe, who was the first player in the league this season to produce a double-double, in which he scored 10 goals and provided 10 assists. He, at the moment, with one game to play, has 22 goals, 11 assists. But Christophe Galtier, who won Manager of the Year for this incredible season with Lille, has confirmed that he's probably going to be sold. In fact, almost will be sold, given the nature of Ligue 1 and its stature, of Lille and its stature in itself. But it's not just Pepe that's been the most incredible player in that Lille side. They have plenty of attackers. And Loic Remy, obviously not to the same calibre, but one goal of the season. And it was because of an incredible, and if you haven't seen it, an incredible, well-thought-out free kick in which there was almost a Panenka over the wall for Loic Remy to spin and volley against Bordeaux. He picked up goal of the season for that. And Lille themselves have just shown to be one of the most complete sides in Ligue 1 this season. They scored 34 goals from open play, 10 from set pieces and 10 from fast breaks. Obviously, PSG, we all know that they're going to absolutely blow teams away in all of these stats. And despite Thomas Tuchel's record-breaking start of the season, it's ended horribly. But only PSG had more goals from fast breaks. And Lille have created this side blessed with incredible wingers such as Rafael Leao, Jonathan Okoné as well, and obviously Nicolas Pepe, who's been linked to the likes of Manchester United and Arsenal. So it was a massive shout out to Lille, who as well set the record for the most passes before a goal, which was in the 5-1 win against PSG, which was the first time PSG conceded 5 in over 10 years, even beyond that, I think. And they also had a game in which 5 goals were all scored and assisted by 10 different players. So this Lille side, if we're talking about, Will, your new favourite team, Atalanta, being one to watch in the Champions League next season, if they do it...
Yeah, if they're in the same... Well, they can't, probably won't be in the same
group. Not in the
together,
same group because of seedings, yeah. But this Lille side, who, even though there is still one game to play, like Serie A, have already guaranteed their Champions League space. If they can keep some of their talent that is there, and obviously Lille, famously under Bielsa, exploded and almost had Monaco season this season, buying loads of players, it not going very well, being low in the table. Gaultier has completely reversed this around, and second place ahead of the likes of Lyon, who, again, if we're talking about my sort of reference of Ligue 1 being a farmer's league in the sense that the produce is so great, you've got the likes of Ndombele, and Folamanu, you mentioned Houssem Aouar in that Lyon side that will probably be plucked. So this Lille team might benefit from the fact that there are so many incredible players in this Ligue 1 division that will be looked at by other clubs. That they might be able to keep a few more than they thought. Yeah, Nicolas Pepe will
be. If they're losing Pepe, that's a huge part of their team. A lot of things, they could do really well in the Champions League, but it all depends on how they replace him. Because if they get it wrong, having to juggle two competitions could sink them. You know what I mean? It could really drag them down in Liga. I hope it doesn't. I hope they replace him with a very well-scouted player or something.
Liga is so volatile in the sense that you've got the likes of Marseille in sixth, Montpellier, Saint-Étienne securing Europa League football next season, which is Aubameyang's old side, where he sort of first got his big break in European football. So there's been... And Rennes obviously beat PSG in the cup and they finished 10th. Strasbourg won the cup as well and they finished 12th. So you've got this bizarre mix of teams where... In England, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They're going into Europe. Obviously, Wolves made it as well because of the FA Cup. In France, you've got a complete collection of all probably equal ability sides, all with incredible individual talents that are going to look to make a better progress in Europe. And with PSG's inability to get past the quarterfinal in the Champions League, Lille might even be a better team to do that if they can replace Pepe, who was named in Team of the Year, alongside Kylian Mbappe, who made history in becoming the first player to win Player of the Year and Young Player of the Year in the same year, scoring 32 goals and providing 7 assists. But after that award, he said that something needs to be done at PSG and they either need to give him more responsibility or he'll look for that more responsibility elsewhere. Yeah. So before I go into my final part about Ligue 1 and one of the most fascinating players of the season itself, quick little views on what Mbappe said and what this could mean for the summer coming up.
I think he's jockeying for position with Neymar as the big dog of the yard. You know, I think Neymar is, when he moved to PSG, obviously it was very much like, Neymar, you are the king. You are our hero. You're our Lord and Saviour. And they're like handing the keys of the kingdom over to him. They're signing Dani Alves. They're trying to make it very comfortable for him. There were rumours they're after Coutinho. You know, they're doing what Neymar wants, letting Neymar run the show. Because he is the best player in the world. He's phenomenal talent. But it's emergence, and obviously he's had two very unlucky injuries and missed massive chunks of the season, including the Champions League elimination. Both times he wasn't there, wasn't fit. And the first time he postponed surgery, you know, just to... he had surgery early, he could have postponed it and played against Real Madrid. He chose not to protect the World Cup. And, you know, his personal life is becoming not a distraction because he's still professional and still training every day, but like, he's getting into fights with people. He skipped the awards dinner recently to go be at Rihanna's fashion launch, which, I mean, okay, fine. You pick hang out with Rihanna over your teammates, but still, you know, it's not a good look for a player who's already being rumoured of, you know, is he happy?
Yeah, this is I don't think even the off-pitch stuff. The interesting thing is that, like, you would have hoped that PSG, when they were building that side, would have been able to build around both Neymar and Mbappe.
I think
they play
can.
Incredibly well together, but now it looks like Mbappe's posturing to be, I want to bring in the players that will make me play
better.
Because
he's probably worried that PSG will acquiesce to Neymar's needs and bring in, like, Coutinho or something, just because he's friends with Coutinho and he loves Coutinho, and why wouldn't you sign? But PSG don't need Coutinho. PSG need different kinds of players. I mean, look, I can see if Tuchel continues there, I mean, who knows if he will, I can see, you know, you play 3-5-2, you put those two up front and you surround them with a team that can create for them. It's entirely plausible. I think Cavani's probably done for, poor guy. You know,
well, he said that he probably will go after his contract expires, which I think is only one or two seasons away.
Yeah, it's not far. And again, I think I mentioned him before. Cavani is sort of like the...
Yeah, he's just
He just seems to exist there and in such a nice way, scoring 30 goals, finishing top scorer. And it's never him posturing for position or anything. But he's getting on now, so it'll be his next move will be so fascinating because obviously he was a cult hero at the likes of Palermo and stuff. Yeah. So I would almost love to see Cavani just tear up... Pack his bags from PSG, go back to Serie A, Atalanta. Atalanta's line in the Champions League.
Replacing Zapata.
Lads, we've cracked it, lads.
We've cracked it. But the Mbappe saga will obviously run for the summer now after him opening that can of worms. We'll have plenty of time to talk about that. But someone that will not get talked about at all, most likely because if you imagine Dimitri Payet not looking like he should be able to play football, this guy... looks 10 times more unlikely to be a footballer, but has been the focal point of 7th place Nîmes in Ligue 1 this season. And this is a set-piece wizard, number 10 / centre midfielder called Teju Savanier. And he's 28 years old, so he's unlikely to be plucked from one of the Europeans' giants and be plonked into one of the best teams in the world. However, he's the most statistically interesting player in the whole of Europe's top 5 leagues this season because, one, I've never seen him appear on any of the query searches I would have done before. This seems like his first major season in which he's exploded. He has provided the most assists in Ligue 1 this season, mainly because of his set-piece delivery. As I said, that's where the Payet comparison comes in more so as well. Just a mercurial, gifted, technical footballer that is able to put the ball wherever he wants. However, he is also the only player in Ligue 1 this season to make 50 tackles, make 50 interceptions, create 50 chances, and complete 50 dribbles. So for a guy that does not look like he's an athletic player or looks like he's going to rampage through entire teams or work really hard, he is the player, arguably, that is the most complete statistically in Ligue 1 in 2018-19. And as I said, Neem finished seventh, so his 13 assists and that outrageous output, which, again, this is... Bakayoko, I remember when he was signed by Chelsea, was a player that had only done 50 tackles, 50 aerial duels and 50 interceptions. Savonier is balancing those defensive output with the ability to create chances from any position on the pitch and also dribble past players. He also wins a lot of fouls. He also commits a lot of fouls. And I just think the fact that he's not spoken about is because it's from a very sort of statistical lens. Maybe when you watch him, he's not as incredible as the stats show, but someone that puts that much output in every statistic you can possibly track on a football pitch deserved some attention, even more so than perhaps the likes of Di Maria, who made it into centre midfield in the Ligue 1 team this season because of his 12 assists and 12 goals, alongside Tanguy Ndombele, who deserves to be there and has been rumoured to be the next Essien or the next Pogba. But Teji Savonier deserved a mention on this podcast as probably my favourite player statistically in the whole of Europe this season, despite Mbappe and the push for more PSG responsibility. Everyone knows he's probably my favourite in itself.
And Savonier is the kind of guy that you can see going and going, he's not an attacking midfielder, not a defensive midfielder, he's just a midfielder. You know, just giving that, because he just seems like he just does everything, doesn't he?
It's
what you.
Yeah. It's incredible. And I think, unless anyone else has any nuggets that I've missed from Ligue 1, as I said, the so-called Farmers League that is looking again to sell all of its best talents to everyone else in the world, with Pepe, with Ndombele. Unfortunately, probably not Savonier, bless him, but interesting. Maybe he could make a move that no one will see coming. But I think that is where we round up our Europe's Top 5 Leagues reviews, with Ligue 1 finishing. So I'd like to say thank you to Mr. La Liga. Mo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Liga.
Mr. Syria.
Thank you, it was a pleasure.
And Mr. Bundesliga.
Cheers.
It's like a Cluedo game, that is. And thank you all for Squawker Talker listeners for listening to us. Please continue with rating and reviewing and subscribing to the podcast. And please, next week, get involved with the listeners' questions. We want more and more possible. We've answered a few there sort of subtly, but if we can have a whole section of listeners' questions, we would love to do it. So make sure you reply when you see the tweet go out. But that will be it for this week. Take care.